2B. In the English pages, it's 2B2. 2B2. Now, Bet Amud Bet 2B2. We are down on the right side. On the right side, the last paragraph. Now, just to review the last subject that we had been discussing, that subject was why it was that the Talmud chose to use the word derech and to use the adjective shalosh derachim, that there are shalosh drachim. Isha nikneit b'shalosh drachim, a woman is acquired in three ways. And we saw the progress here of the discussion of the use of derech, that derech had a connotation, or it was used in certain other places in the Mishnah, where we were talking about natural processes. And so we went from there to say, I concluded the end of the last lecture to say that the subject here has, we brought in now, the natural side of the process, that is to say, bi'ah, the sexual relations that are mentioned in the Mishnah, is a natural process. And the whole idea of marriage, then, using the word derech, reflects the natural nature of the thing. That's certainly not the only possibility for thinking of marriage. Some would argue that it is a very unnatural state of affairs. Many argue that, but I would say that from the Mishnah, you will get a rather different perspective. Now, just again to review the three major methods, the ways of creating the kinyan, the change of status that occurs, is a result of kesef, shtar, and biyah, meaning kesef or shtar or biyah. Kesef, money; shtar, a document; biyah, sexual relations. And then to go back to what I said two times ago, keep in mind that the sexual relations is not a desirable way of doing this. I think that it functions very practically in order to create some legal context for what we call what is it called in American law?
The common law marriage.
That it is possible for the law to recognize a relationship which the parties consider to be a relationship of marriage, where two people are living together as husband and wife. And generally speaking, that is defined as a relationship where there are sexual relations between the two people, and they consider that as part of the fact that they are married. Naturally, there are other possibilities, but it is now possible for us to have a concept of common law marriage. Now, I wanted to show you another biblical passage, which was very pertinent because it was last week's Torah reading, to show you really how in Parshat Chayei Sarah, the one subject that is frequently the most troubling to people, which I have tried to put in a larger context, that is of kesef. That there's a monetary transaction here, I think that you can get a wonderful perspective on the growth of rabbinic law by reading chapter 24 of Genesis. Now, just to recall for you, I'll read it for you largely in English. If you were here last week, so Abraham zaken babi ami, you know this. Abraham was now old, advanced in years, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. And Abraham said to the senior servant of his household, who had charge of all that he owned, "Put your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites." Now here I want to read it, the Hebrew. Asher lo tikach isha. Again, that verb to take. Right? You will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell. Verse 4, but will go to the land of my birth and get a wife for my son Isaac. Now the Hebrew is v'lakachta isha lifni. Again, lakachta, you shall take a son for, a wife for my son Isaac. So the key verb again and again here, always you'll see in the biblical context, is to take. It's to take. So we know the story then that Eliezer goes to the ancestral home of Abraham, to Haran, and there in the family is Bethuel. This is made his way to Aram Naharaim, to the city of Nahor. He made the Nahor was his uncle. That was the brother of Terah. He made the camels kneel down by the well outside the city at eventime, the time when the women came out to draw water. He then prays for God, Eliezer. God, O Lord, God of my master Abraham, grant me good fortune this day and deal graciously with my master Abraham. Here I stand by the spring as the daughters of the townsmen come out to draw. Let the maiden to whom I say, please lower your jar that I may drink, and who replies, drink, and I will also water your camel. Let her be the one whom you have decreed for your servant Isaac. Now, what's the meaning of that? What's he looking for? Looking for somebody who is gracious and kind, and who is going to, before asked, will say, oh, this is not only for you, but this is for your camels too. Now, that's a very quaint Middle Eastern way of saying a really wonderful woman. Okay? So that's what he's looking for. He prays to God for this kind of woman. And then, of course, he had hardly, scarcely finished speaking when Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, came out with her jar on her shoulder. The maiden was very beautiful, a virgin whom no man had known. She went down to the spring, filled her jar, and came up. And the servant ran toward her and said, please let me sip a little water from your jar. Drink, my lord, she said. And she quickly lowered her jar upon her hand and let him drink. And when she had let him drink his fill, she said, I will also draw for your camels. Also draw for your camels until they finished drinking. Quickly emptying her jar into the trough, she ran back to the well to draw, and she drew for all his camels. The man, meanwhile, stood gazing at her, silently wondering whether the Lord had made his errand successful or not. When the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold nose ring weighing a half shekel and two gold bands for her arms, 10 shekels in weight. Pray tell me, he said, whose daughter are you? Is there room in your father's house for us to spend the night? She replied, of course, I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor. And she went on, there is plenty of straw and feed at home, and also room to spend the night. The man bowed low in homage to the Lord and said, blessed be the Lord, the God of Abraham, my master, who has not withheld his steadfast faithfulness from my master. For I have been guided on my errand by the Lord to the house of my master's kinsman. The maiden ran and told all this to her mother's household. Now Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban. Laban ran out to the man at the spring. When he saw the nose ring and the bands on his sister's arms, and when he heard his sister Rebekah say, thus the man spoke to me, he went up to the man who was still standing beside the camels at the spring. Come in, O blessed of the Lord, he said. Why do you remain outside when I have made ready the house and a place for the camels? Now, as the Bible is describing this, what is the feature that is so very attractive that's just thrown in here that's of interest to Laban? It's the jewelry that he suddenly sees. Laban ran out to the man at the spring when he saw the nose ring and the bands on his sister's arm. time, he's very impressed by the wealth that has come from a long distance. Come in, blessed sir, the man entered the house, the camels were unloaded, the camels were given straw, and so on. He explains his mission, and that it all worked exactly as he had prayed that it would work. Then I bowed low in homage to the Lord, the God of my master, who led me on the right way to get the daughter of my master's brother for his son. Now, if you mean to treat my master with true kindness, tell me, and if not, tell me also that I may turn left or right. Then Laban and Bethuel answered, the matter was decreed by the Lord. We cannot speak to you, good or bad. Here is Rebekah before you. In other words, they're saying, this is a done deal. This is a done deal. We're not even going to discuss it any further. Well, what do they know about it? They know a few things. There is family, and that's apparently a positive here. It's reflected on positively. And, of course, he comes bearing, I left out all the camels that he came with. He had left with many, many camels. Asara Gamalim. He's one guy with 10 camels. Now, why does one guy carry, go with 10 camels? Because the 9 of the camels are laden. All right? They're laden with gifts. All right? For this prospective bride.
What kind of guy would have a young woman slip all that water for his 10 camels without him doing it himself? Why shouldn't he have
Well, I guess he wanted this is going to be the sign from God. This was going to be the sign. Well, that's the way he planned it. That's what he was looking for. I hear somebody. Okay, so it's a done deal. Here is Rebekah before you. Take her and go. Let her be a wife to your master's son. When Abraham's servant heard their words, he bowed low to the ground before the Lord. The servant brought out objects of silver and gold and garments and gave them to Rebekah. And he gave presents to her brother and her mother. And he and the men with him ate and drank, and they spent the night. When they arose next morning, he said, give me leave to go to my master. But her brother and her mother said, let the maiden remain with us some 10 days, then you may go. He said to them, do not delay me. Now that the Lord has made my errand successful, give me leave that I may go to my master. They said, let us call the girl and ask for her reply. They called Rebekah and said to her, will you go with this man? And she said, I will. So they sent off their sister Rebekah and her nurse along with Abraham's servant and his men. And they blessed Rebekah and said to her, O sister, may you grow into thousands of myriads. May your offspring seize the gates of their foes. And Rebekah and her maids arose, mounted on the camels, and followed the man. So the servant took Rebekah and went his way. And then the last paragraph, which I pointed out when we read it on Saturday morning, Isaac had just come back from the vicinity of Be'er Lahai Roi, for he was settled in the region of the Negev. And Isaac went out walking in the field toward evening, and looking up, he saw camels approaching. Raising her eyes, Rebekah saw Isaac. She alighted from the camel and said to the servant, who is that man walking in the field toward us? And the servant said, that is my master. So she took her veil and covered herself. The servant told Isaac all the things he had done. Isaac then brought her into the tent of his mother Sarah. And he took Rebekah as his wife. Isaac loved her and thus found comfort after his mother's death. That really is the end now of the beginning of the parsha, which is the death of Sarah. The death of Sarah ends when Isaac is married. And the details that we are given are simply extraordinary details here. When she alights from the camel, I pointed that out in the service on Saturday, that Inafla, that she fell off the camel. In the Hebrew says she fell off the camel. So that there's a tremendous picture here of this young woman. She falls up, she sees the guy, she falls off the camel, she gets married to him, and they are in love, At least he loves her. I mean, that the text clearly says. She comes into his tent, and then he loves her. He comes to love her. Now, as basic to the process here is the activity and the impressive nature of the gifts that are born by Eliezer and that are given to the family of the bride. When we think about marriage, and particularly when we think of ancient marriage, generally we think of the dowry. And what is the dowry? The dowry is something that is given by whom to whom?
The bride.
Is given by the bride to the groom. Now, what do you see was given by the bride to the groom here?
The finest money.
Nothing. Yes, we see her behavior, that this is very extraordinary, beautiful, loving, wonderful behavior. Okay? But there's no transaction between the family. There's no giving of anything except, of course, the key goods, which are to say the wife. Okay? The nature of the transaction is that it is the groom's side that gives something to the bride's side. That is the key piece of what is going on here. It is a gift from the groom's side to the bride's side. And it is not a dowry. It's not at all a dowry. Dowry is the opposite. And that you do not have here. Dowry, actually, have a dowry in Jewish law, very different concept. Very different concept. It has to do with property issues, property that the wife brings into the marriage. And there was in pre-modern times, at least, there may still be in modern times, I'm not sure, a sense of a woman having her own property, of that property coming into the marriage, and the determination made of what is done with that property once it's in the marriage. Or should the husband be responsible for the basic pieces of property? Basic pieces of property are things like bedclothes, dress, for everyday dress, let's say, and special dress, Sabbath dress, issues like that. We know from the Talmud of Masechet Ketubot that those were considered the dowry that was brought in. But the classic structure of marriage in the Torah is what you read in Genesis 24. And that is where the gift comes from the groom's side to the bride's side. To the bride's side. He, of course, getting the bride as a result. Now, of course, the way one could conceive of this is as a bride price. Right? That you're paying the price for the bride. One of the reasons that I wanted to read the context of the story is that while there may be some historical reference to a price, frankly, it doesn't work that way. It's very much different in real life. In real life, it's much more along the lines of, oh, is she marrying into a good family? Does he have money? You know, is he going to be able to support? And so on. This is the context. The context is one where there's a familial sense. The context is one where love enters into the picture as well. It doesn't start that way, but it ends that way, and it is certainly a part of the picture that is drawn here in Genesis 24. These are all the dimensions to it. So I think it would be diminishing the story to say that Eliezer bought her. I don't think that's what's happening at all. I think what's happening here is the real-life reality of the politics of families, the extent to which money is relevant in that, and any of you who have children or are the products of families, it's certainly true a generation ago, and I won't say anything about whether it's true today, but a generation ago, I remember when I started my rabbinate, the politics of families was central. I remember dealing with young people, and particularly in this neighborhood, where who you married, the family you married into, and family meant not the academic accomplishments of the family. It meant the financial history of the family. remember the verses of when you were marrying into money or marrying up or down. What does that up or down mean? Up or down is entirely economic. It's our sense of the economy of the whole thing. So I think that's to a great extent of what is going on here. What we have then in the Talmud, in the Mishnah, is in fact, I think, something that is a later development of what you see in Genesis 24. Keep in mind, it's 2,000 years later. Now, in 2,000 years in those days, it wasn't like 2,000 years today. So it's probably like 200 years or something like that, just in terms of social development. Things move a lot slower than the ancient world. Excuse me. But that having been said, what you have in the Mishnah is that you later have the development now of the giving of something from the groom to the bride. Now, of course, the bride's family is in fact left out in the Mishnah. It's just the giving of from the groom to the bride. That's it, number one. Number two, and so that's a development. Family, at least as far as the Mishnah goes, the family is left out. It's only the woman. Number two, the amount of the gift has diminished quite considerably. Namely, in the Bet Hillel says it's a fruta and a shave fruta, something that's worth a penny, or it is an object worth a penny. Of course, Bet Shammai is interested in real money, and something that really has value, that to symbolize this transition there should be something of real value. Of course, the law will eventually go, according to Hillel, so that the whole idea then becomes just absolutely formalized. And we later have Keses, I think, as a much, much later development down the road of what we had seen in Genesis 24.
What about the Ketubah? Does that also enter into the role of giving?
No, because the Ketubah has a different role in this arrangement. The Ketubah has a role, first of all, as far as dowry goes. Dowry was written into the Ketubah, and that was important because the nature of property that came into the relationship were two types of, women could have two types of property, what's called nechsei malog and nechsei tzom barzel. The key one here is the nechsei tzom barzel. Nechsei tzom barzel means if a woman comes in with a certain amount of property, that property can be written down in the Ketubah. The Ketubah then makes the assumption that during the marriage, the husband will have the right to use the interest on the property, but she has the property, this property is secure, so that he owes her that amount of money at the end of the marriage. Whenever that is, either from death or from divorce. So if they get divorced, let's say you bring down $1,000, okay? $1,000 is written into the Ketubah, okay? So that's one. Then the Ketubah explicitly details obligations of the husband to the wife. Most of it is the obligations of the husband to the wife. The function of the Ketubah is also to discourage divorce. You know about the Ketubah. The purpose of the Ketubah is to create some disincentive for a husband to divorce the wife. Judaism had a very liberal divorce law, right from the time of the Torah, especially in the Talmud. Very liberal divorce law. Not exactly, but it's close to a no-fault divorce law. Seems like a very modern thing, and it seems, since we think of things that are modern as good, seems like a good thing. There's a downside to it. The downside was that because it was so easy to get divorced, men would very frequently divorce their wives when the wives got older. So it was it's a trophy wife kind of phenomenon. The men were interested in younger wives, and the women were left high and dry because it was very easy to get divorced. Okay. Generally speaking, the wives were not interested in that. The wives were interested in the stability of their families. The men, however, were interested in younger wives. So the rabbis had to discourage divorce, or they wanted to discourage divorce. As I said to you last week and the week before, there were limitations on how much they could discourage divorce. They couldn't outlaw it. The Catholic Church outlawed it. Right? The Catholic Church outlawed it, and there we had divorce Italian style. Mm-hmm. You could shoot her, but you couldn't, that's the only way you could have a divorce. Right? We have divorce because divorce is written into the Torah. The Torah gives you the structure of divorce, so it's very hard to get rid of it. So that they couldn't really handle. They couldn't, it would be very difficult to make a change in those things. What they tried to do then was to discourage divorce. They tried a number of ways to discourage divorce. Eventually, what turned out to be the most effective way of discouraging divorce was to make it expensive for the husbands. Simply to make it expensive. And the ketubah then functioned as a promissory note, which came due upon the dissolution of the marriage. All right? It was only payable on the dissolution of the marriage. As a result of that, the men stopped divorcing their wives. That was the most effective of all. They tried numbers of steps in the development of the ketubah. The final development is where it's turned into a promissory note that is issued at the time of the marriage itself. And that was very effective in discouraging divorce. Now, that is completely different than what we're reading about. The star that we are reading about is a document which says, with this document I thee wed. That's a different document. Yes.
Well, I like the Genesis the best, because, first of all, the money is going first to the wife, sequentially, which shows...
She gets the nose ring first.
Right. And the bracelet.
The bracelet. Well, nose is very up to date.
No one knows.
Of her value, her intrinsic value.
Right.
There really isn't a negotiation with the family, although I must say, the line you read that says this is a done deal, when I've read it in English, and knowing Laban's personality, after that, then he comes up with the gifts for them, and then they seem much more enthusiastic about it. So I was wondered whether or not that wasn't a Middle East way of saying, you know, you've got these camels here, let's think about what's in those camels. So that was the way I always interpreted the sequence of events. But I think the message that comes across is the value of the woman, you know, the dignity and the value of the woman, and the money is the way in which the society indicates the seriousness of
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
It is the mode of exchange, and okay. here the abundance and the free giving.
Uh-huh.
So it's the two things, the abundance and the free giving, the fact that for women isn't a negotiation,
uh-huh.
I think reads the sense of the woman's value.
You will see this coming up again in the Gemara. It's slightly different form, but this point is going to be made by the Gemara also. Awesome. Good. Yes.
The Dorso is the one year apart between the Kiddushin and the Chatmara.
No, that's interesting. You do not show that.
You don't. They're not even talking about it.
Correct. As far as you don't see any evidence, the only evidence you do see, though, is remember Eliezer says, "Let's go right now," and they say, "No, let's wait 10 days." So that there is that delay is there, and it's not explained, the delay. And my thought always was that, you know, they want to just get used to the fact that she's leaving rather than just have her leave. Well, having said that, maybe that's what the year is about also. This year that we were talking about, that later becomes the structure, and of course the year is not a legislative year. Year can be, it can be as much as a year. It can be less than a year also, but there always is some sort of a delay. And maybe that is, the function of that is for the family to get used to the fact that she's leaving. And that, of course, on the other side, that he's leaving. That in fact, there's going to be a major, there's going to be a major change, but it happens in steps rather than all at once.
and surprising is Eliezer saying the God of my master.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Eliezer, he wasn't Jew. He wasn't.
Well, he was a Hittite. I mean, he was a local.
He wasn't in Hebrew. He has a Hebrew name.
It's a Hebrew name.
Eliezer. It's like he has the God's name in his name. You know.
Abraham gave him
the name. It's hard to say.
It's very interesting.
But, we know that these pagans, one of the nice things about pagans is that they, among other things, they can be nice. You know, we shouldn't think so negatively of pagans, because the Bible paints their bad side. But they also, pagans can be nice. I mean, we've seen a number of pagans so far. Remember Melchizedek. Melchizedek comes out to greet Abraham. Abraham greets him. They have a lovely relationship. Melchizedek relates to El Elyon, you know, the high god.
Yeah. El is not necessarily a Hebrew god.
Correct. Although maybe he's referring to Abraham's god. I mean, you don't know when you read the Torah. I'm just trying to say that maybe we shouldn't paint the pagans in too bad a light, even though this story itself, of course, is doing it for us, because Abraham wants to have his son marry someone not of the people among whom I live, it says. So obviously there's a religious problem that he's responding to about those people, so it's negative on that score, but then Eliezer comes off pretty good.
I wonder, you mentioned that one of the reasons, if not the reason, key reason for the Ketubah was the discouragement of divorce as an answer to the problem of men seeking younger wives and elder women being abandoned. One of the easiest solutions, I would think, was adopted by other societies, was the development of polygamy. Because that took care of the elder women. They stayed in the family continue to roll and they develop, and of course it continues, you know, today.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, okay, you know, what we say about polygamy.
It's an interesting point, because you're quite right. I mean, the Bible has assumed polygamy, although the more you read in the Bible, particularly as things go on, the fewer, as time goes on, people have fewer and fewer wives. By the time you get to the Talmud, I think there's one incident of somebody with more than one wife in the Talmud. So that the Talmud that we're reflecting a Talmudic reality is a reality where already the downside of polygamy is clear. The downside probably from the woman's perspective, although maybe also from the man's perspective, because the Talmud is very concerned about, if you read Masechet Ketubot, for example, one of the problems of having a wife is that you are financially responsible for the wife. And if that weren't bad enough, you're responsible for taking care of her either at the status of your family or the status of her family, whichever is higher. Now that's a very bad setup. That's not good. I mean, I would have thought that you're responsible for taking care of her as befits someone of your means. You know?
To keep the wife at the same level as she came from.
But that could run down, too. I mean, she's got to, you know, she'll wear out her dresses. What happens then? This is the way the thing is structured. I'm just saying that it's really structured in such a way to, I think, severely discourage polygamy. Polygamy is just too expensive. There, too, economically, it's very expensive, let alone the sexual side of it, let alone the psychological, the intimate side of the relationship between the husband and the wife, and all of those scores. And remember, the key metaphor that you have, eventually in Judaism, by the prophetic books, the metaphor that you're dealing with is the metaphor of husband and wife, God and the people of Israel. Right? And that cannot be a polygamous metaphor, because that would be a metaphor of, possibly in terms of God, of many gods. So it becomes limited.
One thought, when we said the 10 days is a possible explanation for the two
process. I don't think so here because it seems they changed their mind too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Because as soon as they probably got a negotiation and she left the next day, I can't imagine that if they really wanted to insist on the 10 days that they wouldn't have forced the issue.
Uh-huh. What did I say? A bird in the hand is worth... I think that... But my reading of it is they didn't want to lose a good deal.
Right.
They had a good deal, and you try for a minute, it doesn't work. All right.
Or they got the one they wanted.
Exactly. They did well.
Maybe 10 days they can get more.
It could also be the other side that can get nothing.
You don't renegotiate.
Okay. Exactly. Okay.
But yes. We have contracts in the New York state law that you're allowed to get out of within 3 days or something like that because they're considered very momentous. Realizing that sometimes some decisions are of a nature that reflection is part of the process.
That can be useful, right?
On the point of polygamy, there was a basic social reason in those times among all peoples that due to the many wars, there was a much larger number of women than men, and to give the women the possibility to have a normal family life, polygamy was introduced. In fact,
also
the father paid for it, so that his daughter may have a normal life, more or less.
I mean, that's also relevant. Back to the text now. We're on 2B2. Did you have a question?
I just wanted to ask, has anyone ever commented why we consider Rebecca a gentle, generous woman when she received, took jewelry from people she didn't know without question? But she just put on the band and put on the nose ring has always struck me as incongruous with the rest of your explanation.
Mm-hmm.
For a young woman to take things that we have discerned for a significant monetary value, from a person she doesn't know, that part
has
never commented on.
What about her marrying somebody she doesn't see?
She doesn't know that yet.
She realized very soon she understands the family, and the family connections are clear connections.
But doesn't he just give it to her after she's on the
board? Yes, the very first reaction was like that. That's
right. Right, you're all very eager.
Sure.
I mean, I think she too.
Right.
I don't get the money and the bracelets. I mean, I would like the dentist too, but in the context of her being beautiful, and then she falls off the camel, and he falls in love. And so, why is there so much emphasis on the monetary stuff? I mean, previously we talked about how the money could be symbolic. Why does it have to be an upkeep point?
Any comments? I think it
would be better.
Abraham wanted a down payment. He didn't want to renegotiate every few weeks. Abraham wanted to make sure that Eliezer would come back with a wife.
Mm-hmm. First of all, that's true. First of all, I would say that what's being reflected here is the world in which they lived. That's number one. So that the world in which they lived, these kinds of concerns, family concerns, monetary concerns, were part of the world in which they live. And as I was saying before, I'm not sure that that has changed dramatically, although it's changed some in the last 3-4 years, probably. 30 minutes. I see a little bit of this going on anyway. A little bit.
The kids at school all talk about the size of their diamond ring, the 28-year-old. It is pervasive.
Okay. But, in terms,
you know,
so that's where number one is contextually. Contextually.
She's worth every penny.
Contextually, there's a context for it. Okay? So, I don't, and that probably has to do with the nature of marriage as it was in that time and that place. Number two, I think that what is being demonstrated by the story is the crudeness of that family. And it is an implicit attack on Laban, the brother. And this is going to continue. It's going to continue for two generations. We're building up an image of somebody who, in fact, the Bible doesn't like. And the first introduction to that person is here, and I think it's in a rather effective literary context. Namely, it's not one-sided. There's a larger context to it. And I think that the most effective way of building a hateful character is slowly and not quickly. If we would learn immediately that he was all bad, we wouldn't like that. But at this stage of the game, we think some things about him, but we're really not sure about him. The next generation is going to come. He's going to be the key player and the culprit in terms of the deception of Jacob. And that's down the road. So I think that that's also why this... I don't think that this is necessarily, because it's telling us, is meant to tell us this positively. The Bible will occasionally, and it usually takes in the Bible several chapters in order to see the real implications of the story you're reading. Sometimes it takes much more than that. It takes another book of the Bible. But the Bible works like that. It usually doesn't tell you immediately what its point of view is. Characteristic of Genesis especially, but you'll learn within the next 10 chapters what its point of view is. So that, I think, is what's going on. Okay, back to the summary. 2b2, bottom right hand side of the page. We're discussing Derachim, Derech as indicating nature or things that happen naturally. Okay? The last matter discussed, remember, was Bia. Sex is natural. And the question the Talmud said, well, what about the other things? This Kesef Star and Bia. There's money, there's a document and Bia. So it's two that are not natural, that are just formalistic. The third is Bia. That's nature. So if you're saying that the word Derech is because of the nature side, but there are two things that are not natural and one is. So two should outweigh one. And remember, there was another possibility. There was Dirachim or Divarim. Divarim. The Mishnah could have been written to have said Divarim. There are three things that can cause a woman to be married to a man. Three things. There are three things. But it says three ways. Right? So the Gemara concluded, no, Bia is the central one. In marriage, it's really sex that defines the fact that these two people are married, even though these other things, in fact, are necessary to arrive at that. It is the nature of the sexual relationship that is the crucial thing here. Okay? Now, v'ibayit emahamani. Or, I can explain to you why derachim is used instead of divarim. I can do it the following. Rabbi Shimoni, by telling you that this whole view, this way things are expressed, goes according to the point of view of Rabbi Shimon. Titania, because Rabbi Shimon says in the Baraita to Rabbi Shimon Omer, Rabbi Shimon says, Rabbi Shimon Omer, mipnei ma amra Torah. Why did the Torah say, ki kach ish isha? Why that a man shall take a woman. Right? It says it, a man shall take. A man is an active verb. He's the subject of the sentence. It's an active verb as opposed to a passive verb. Right? So why does it say, ki yikach ish isha, velokatat ki tilakach isha le'ish, and it's not written in the passive sense, when a woman is taken by a man, it says when a man will take, and it doesn't say when a woman is taken by the man. Why? What's the force of that? Mipnei shedarko shel ish lechazer al ha'isha. Ve'en darka shel isha lechazer al ha'ish. Because it is the way of a man to go looking for a woman, and not the way of a woman to go looking for a man. That's a little bit of insight into what they consider to be male and female nature. And it goes on, Mashali Adam Avdalo Aveda. This is like a man who has lost something. A man who has lost something. Mi chozer al mi. Who goes looking for what? Dal Aveda, mechazer al Aveda to. The person who lost something goes to look for the thing he lost. The thing he lost doesn't go to look for him. What's the symbol here?
I don't get it.
The symbol is he's looking for his rib. Right? The man lost the rib. And so he is looking for his rib. And here the natural sense of the male being more aggressive. The sense is the male is the aggressive party here. Ki yikach ish isha, okay? When a man will take the wife, right? Now, there the language was derech, right? Ein darka shel ha'isha. It is not the derech, the way of a woman. In other words, this is not natural. It is natural for a man to take the leading role, the initiating role in this, what that will lead to the marriage. Now whether that's true or not, no comment. Or whether there are just different ways that the male takes a role and the female takes a role, and look at the psychiatrist, you guys. The male thinks he's taking a role, and he thinks he's got choice in the matter, and but we know the reality. Okay? This is a set of
options. It's that way with all the animals.
If the male is the aggressive, the lead takes the leading place. I think that this is probably fairly well accepted, except among Jews. I think part of the mentality of Jews, and it's a very big problem with which we deal, is that the women, it's the notion of the powerful woman. And in fact, women manipulate men. And that's one of the reasons that if you read the literature, why it is said that Jewish men like to marry Gentile women. Because the Gentile women are much more
pliant,
docile, and this is the myth. This is the way Jewish men frequently think about the nature of the male and the female, and of the Jewish woman per se. It has to do with the Jewish princess kind of thing. It's very interesting.
What?
I hope not. I hope not.
Maybe what you're looking for is love. That Isaac found comfort with Rebecca after his mother's death.
Mm-hmm.
And looking for his mother would also tie in with one of the issues of why you want to make your argument of why Jewish men want to go after Gentiles.
I wouldn't know
that.
Not at all.
If your mother is being pushy, aggressive, demanding women, even so they're compelled to go look for their mother, but they don't like the kind they knew, then they're going to
get out of that. That's a roundabout way. So they're looking for the opposite, right?
In terms of the man taking you really have to do that if the man is going to give against the woman. I mean, if he's taking the woman, then he has to also release the woman.
Yeah, well, that would be true. That would follow also, right?
Yeah.
Right. So that, because they would both, there would be, one would balance the other. Exactly. That's correct.
Yes? If the man has lost a bit of or a part of himself, from that one might infer that a man has to be replaced, has to marry.
Correct. Absolutely correct. That is, Midrash develops that idea. We have made mention of it in a slightly different form, what I call the myth of the androgyne, as it appears in the Talmudic literature, which is that there was an original creature, and the creatures got separated, and the male looks for the female looks for the male, in order to come together. This sees the rib, in fact, as not being just an equal part, but as something which the male feels he has lost, and therefore which is a particular motivating source. But it's along the lines of what you said.
Can a woman say what?
Nope. No. So, particularly as it is in the androgyne story, She also is looking for her other half. So the two look. In this context, that's not what's said. I mean, let's not hear what Rabbi Shimon is trying to demonstrate is simply an, from the men's perspective, I guess, about the use of derech, that this is just the way of the world, this is human nature. And that's why this whole story comes in the name of Rabbi Shimon, because this illustrates the use of derech as being human nature. And that then explains to us why it says shalosh derachim, why does it say three ways as opposed to three things? Because we are talking about human nature.
In Abraham and Sarah, I think there are two aspects. One is the dangers of polygamy, but also the strength of the woman, because Sarah tells him to give up his
child. Oh, no doubt about it.
And so I think you see both of these issues.
No, no doubt about it.
First marriage that we look at.
And it continues with all the subsequent marriages here, too. In each of them, there is a strong woman figure. And in nearly all cases, she's on God's side, too. Because remember that it's perfectly reasonable for Abraham to not want to send his son away, Ishmael. And yet God says to him, listen to what your wife said. So God comes to the support of Sarah. So she is very strong in opposing him. And she's got God on her side.
He was not their son.
I was going to say, Abraham thought so. Abraham treats him like a son. Okay? Okay, we go on. Okay, 2b3. The Hadith Nan. Now, the Talmud is going to continue a little while longer this subject of Dirachim, that there are three ways. So it has helped us to really expand our concept of what is going on to discuss issues of nature and of human nature. Now it's going to test out going in a slightly different direction, but it's going to stick with us for still a little while longer. B'shivat Dirachim bodkim et azav. There is a discussion in the Talmud, in the Mishnah, there are seven ways that one checks a zav. I mentioned to you last time, a zav is a male, condition of the male, an illness of the genital system, some sort of gonorrheal type of an issue is coming out, and there are, this is of significance in the law because it leads a man to be ritually impure, which means that he can't go into the temple precinct. And generally speaking, the generative faculty, the generative liquids, are responsible for leading to states of impurity. It is true for menstruation, it is true also for normal ejaculation in the male, and it is true for this issue that comes out of the male member, which is an illness. So, because it's an illness, one has to know whether there's an illness. It becomes a medical issue. And therefore, there are, as the Mishnah describes, Shiv'ad Rachim Bokim et Azav. There are seven ways to check this to see whether this falls under the category of Azav. This illness called Azav. Litmei Devarim. Since it is just talking about these sort of objective things, this is not nature. This is things. So here, derachim is used not to indicate things that are natural, but in a way, things that are unnatural. It's an illness. Okay? So, litmei Devarim. If you're right that derachim is always used in that limited context of the natural, then why would they use it in this context? You see the way the argument goes? You're just taking another literary example from the Mishnah and saying your argument doesn't hold. It should have said there, if you were right that it's only natural things, it should have said Lipne Devarim. In this case, it should have said seven things. Okay? Hata makamash malan. There in the Mishnah Zavim, the word derachim is used, which has a natural overtone to it, because darka d'nichli yeter la'ato yili yedei ziva, darka d'nishtaya yeter la'ato yili yedei ziva. It is natural for overeating to lead to some of these discharges, as it is natural for overdrinking to lead to some of these discharges as well. Now, I have no idea what they're talking about, but this was the medicine of their times. Okay? That the Talmud is answering that there are certain things that have to do with the consumption of food and drink which can produce these types of odd conditions. That is to say, then, it is not unnatural, it's natural. And since it is natural, we at least have some phenomena that are meant as natural results of certain actions. You are what you eat, you are what you drink. I think we have this concept. And therefore, it makes sense to use derachim. Therefore, we know, yes, derech is used for things that are showing us human nature. Okay. Goes on again. Tahat itnan etrog shabeli iland bishlosha derachim. Elsewhere now we have another Mishnah that again uses derachim. And in the following way it says, an etrog is like a tree in three ways. Litne devarim. It should have said in three things. Now, what do you mean an etrog is like a tree in three ways? An etrog is a tree. So what do you mean to say an etrog is like a tree? Let's take a look at the Rashi here.
It's interesting that they do the design instead of the sheva or the gimel instead of shalosh.
That's just the printing.
You think so?
Yep, it's just printing. Let me just see whether it's in the Rashi. I don't see it. An etrog is like a tree in three ways. What ways is it like a tree? In fact, there are a variety of things that affect the trees in the land of Israel. Fruits come off trees in the land of Israel. If you have a tree, tree is subject to the laws of three things, especially. It's actually more than three, but there are three things that are pointed out here that characterize the tree. One is the law of Orla. The other is the law of Levi'i. And the third is the law of Shvi'it. Explain what each of these means. If you plant a tree in the ground and it starts to produce fruit, you are not allowed to harvest and use that fruit for the first 3 years. Okay, that's the law of Orla. Now, it's not at all unlikely that that is a very intelligent law for good agriculture. People tell me who plant fruit trees that the first few years that your tree grows, you don't get good fruit out of it. And that you have to wait till the fourth year or so to get decent apples or decent pears out of your fruit trees. The fourth year, you are required to take that fruit and bring it to the temple in Jerusalem and eat it there. Or cash it in where you live, take the food, and then take the money, and then go to a restaurant in Jerusalem. Right, there you go to a King David Hotel.
You have a lot of fruit.
You take a lot of people out for dinner. Okay? Take a lot. In the King David Hotel, you're not going to eat so much for all that fruit. That doesn't say you're going to have a small meal. You're going to have an appetite. There's all your fruit in the gallery. Okay? So vegetation, that's in the first year. Okay, so it's the second of the laws of fruit trees. Third of the laws of fruit trees is the law of Shvi'it. The law of Shvi'it is actually a law that we're in right now. It's the Shemitah, is the law. The laws of Shemitah. Laws of Shemitah are that you're not allowed to plant, you're not allowed to harvest these things during the sabbatical year. As I say, we are now right in the middle of that. Another number of weeks I'm going to address the subject in our Zaruah, but not till it's in the Torah week. Wait until it's in the Torah Parshat Mishpatim. So I will hold off, I've been holding off to address the laws of Shemitah. But this is now a Shemitah year. So a lot of controversy in Israel now, and it actually affects the Jews in the diaspora to some extent. It affects Israeli products that can be purchased abroad, fruits from Israel, it affects kosher wine, it affects all of these things. So those are three things that are characteristic of the laws of trees. Right? Another thing that affects the laws of trees, which the Etrog does not share, is when, in fact, the tree is subject to the second tithe. Second tithe is all fruit as well as vegetables have to be tithed. It's called the first tithe. That tithe goes to the Levites. There is then a second tithe that is taken. Second tithe goes in years number 1 and 2. Has to be brought to Jerusalem. You have to eat it in Jerusalem, or if you don't want to do that, you have to cash it in where you are, and then you go to David's citadel. Not where King David is, to David's citadel time. I'm joking. You go wherever you want. You go to Jerusalem. You have to spend your money there.
And year
in year, in that what?
What's an Arab restaurant?
Depends if it's kosher. plenty of good Arab restaurants, plenty of kosher. So in year three, that tithe is given to the poor. In year 4 and 5, you have to take it to Jerusalem. In year 6, it goes to the poor. Year 7 is the Shemitah year, and there are no tithes in the Shemitah year. That's why there's no tithes in the Shemitah year. The Shemitah year, the produce is not tithed, because any fruit that goes on your tree is not yours. You have no proprietary rights to it. Anybody can come. I was just reading a book today about Shemitah, and actually how you deal with that today. Let's say you have a fruit tree in your yard in Israel. Are you allowed to go in and take a guy's fruit tree? Is the fruit off his tree? The truth is, you're not allowed to, because you're not allowed to cross his property boundaries. He's not allowed to withhold his fruit from you, but you're not allowed to walk on his property without his permission. So what he should do is that he should, if he has property that he wants to keep you out of, he's supposed to put, one of the sources I read today says, he should put a sign in front of the house saying, ring the bell first. there are people who do this too. There are people, you will see this in Israel now. People will take the fruit from their trees, they'll put it in a bushel, put it out in front of the house. That's for people to come in, because he has no proprietary rights to his fruit. It's a very interesting law. I mean, it's extraordinary law. It's very, very interesting, both economically and religiously and ecologically. Extraordinarily interesting laws. I know some people who are really putting in full time now, just dealing with this as eco-friendly, the eco-friendly side of these things, what it means, you know, and that concept. But having said what I just said, I told you year 1 and 2 goes a certain way, year goes, year 3 goes, you have to deal with it differently, year 4 and 5, certainly year 6. The question to you is, when does the year begin?
Yeah, it's not the plant in different years, so how do they can people?
What do we mean by year?
Yeah, Rosh Hashanah Le'ilama.
Well, but let's say, yes, the season. But what do I mean? If you have, let's say you have apple, what's an Israeli fruit? Rimoni. Pomegranate. It's a basic, one of the seven species, pomegranate. So you have pomegranate. At what point does the year begin? It begins at Rosh Hashanah. But how do I know? Am I talking about whether the pomegranate tree has blossomed and has pomegranates on it? And if that has happened by Rosh Hashanah, the year has begun, let's say it's happened the day before Rosh Hashanah, 2 days before Rosh Hashanah. My pomegranates come out, and I have full-blown pomegranates. Are they last year? Or does it come from the moment that I harvest the pomegranates? Alright? In fact, with pomegranates, it's when the pomegranates blossom. That's the law of trees. The law of the etrog is different. That's why there are three ways that the etrog is like a tree. And not four ways. Okay? Alright, so that's what the Mishnah is going to tell us. And it is using then derachim. Shalosh derachim. There are three ways. Etrog shavela ilan begimel derachim. The etrog is similar to a tree, namely to the pomegranates, in three ways. Litne devarim. It should have said three things, not three ways. If ways mean totally naturally, these are not totally naturally. I just told you, what's more natural? Why do you say one thing is more natural than another, that you declare the year from the time the thing comes out as opposed to the time that it's harvested? Is one more natural than the other? It's hard to say. Mishum de be'inan matne sefer. Well, the end of that Mishnah, in fact, does refer to something that is natural. The etrog is similar to a vegetable in one way. It is similar to a vegetable because, in fact, it is tithed the way vegetables are tithed. And that is when it's harvested. That's the harvest. When it's fully grown and it's ready to be taken off the tree, and it is taken off the tree, and that's, it's a fairly natural thing. That's what agriculture is all about, when the thing finally is ready to be eaten. Okay? So, in that way, it was the end of the Mishnah that, in fact, carries the sense of the natural. Then the Gemara says, Hatam hakamashmalan. There, in the final clause regarding the similarity of the etrog to a vegetable, this is what the Mishnah's use of derech informs us. The darkei de etrog ki yerek. But the way the derech of an etrog, the way it grows, is similar to that of a vegetable. And that's why it's considered like a vegetable. How? Ma yerek darko ligadel al kol mayim. Just as a vegetable grows with any water source. That is to say, there are two types of water sources in the land of Israel. One is rain, and the other is irrigation. Okay? A rimon that I used before, the pomegranate, doesn't grow with irrigation. It grows naturally. Rimonim are not irrigated. They just grow. In the land of Israel, it rains for several months. That is enough to provide all of the water necessary for a pomegranate. Okay? But the etrog is different. Right? The etrog is sometimes grown by irrigation, and sometimes it is grown naturally. Right? So in that way, it is naturally like a yerek, vegetables, right? Because it is grown with irrigation. Vegetables are grown with... In the land of Israel, you cannot grow vegetables just with the rain that falls. You have to irrigate to grow vegetables, okay?
You get a very poor product if you try.
If you try what?
If you try to grow a vegetable, I think about during the war, and everybody had victory gardens and you relied on rain.
Here?
No, it isn't.
In Israel, it wouldn't be very good.
No, it
wouldn't be very good at all. Okay? So again, we see that derech is used for natural things. Want to go on? Now the Gemara will object again. Haditman, koi yesh bo derachim shaver lechaya. Again, the use of derachim. A koi has derachim, has ways in which it is like a chaya, and it has ways in which it is like a behema. Now, this is esoteric law, but you learn a lot. Here there's a little bit of zoology. In the Bible, there are two basic categories of animals. Well, there are actually three basic categories of animals. But of what we call, in the mammalian of mammals, there are two categories and one exception. The two categories are behema, and those are the domesticated mammals, and the chaya, which is the wild mammals. Okay? Now, among the kosher animals are both. There are kosher domesticated animals, and most of the kosher animals are domesticated. There are a smaller number of wild kosher animals, the most relevant of which, in terms of production, of eating, and of actually using them, is the deer. Right? A deer is a chaya. A deer is not a behema. A deer is a chaya. And deer meat, what is it called? Venison. Venison is a very popular meat. The question is, and there are different laws for these two types of animals. The chaya, the Torah specifically says that when you slaughter the chaya, and of course, in order to be eaten, the animal has to be slaughtered in a kosher fashion. But the chaya, you have to cover the chaya's blood with the dirt of the earth. After you've slaughtered the animal, you have to then take the dirt and cover up the blood. It's fascinating symbol, because the wild animal requires an activity of making you conscious of spilling the blood. Whereas the domesticated animal exists in a way for that purpose, because you're domesticating the animal in order to eat the animal. The wild animal is a problem in the Torah. And the wild animal, therefore, you have to cover the blood. Now, there is, in rabbinic literature, a question about one particular animal called the koi. The koi, the question is whether a koi is a behema or a chaya. And they cannot figure out, given the zoology, the anatomy of the animal, as well as the behavior of the animal, how to classify this animal. Now, of course, unfortunately, we don't know what this animal is. We don't know what it is. We don't know what it is. The theory is that it's a buffalo. You have those? You have buffaloes in this? Oh, sure. You have it till today? You have it till? Water buffalo. You have water buffalo in the Galilee. They're natural to the Galilee. Why? Water buffalo, sure. The wild animals. Yeah. So that was classic. You've always had water buffalo in that part of the world. So the Israelis have them. They've restored all the water buffalo to the Galilee today. In the Chula Swamp. That they've returned now into a swamp for a good part of it, they again brought the water buffalo back. So the koi possibly is a water buffalo, but we're not sure. We're just not sure. One of the problems with names of animals is that where you have clear physical characteristics in the Torah, somewhat easy to define them. But many of the animals, we just don't know what they are. That's the problem with the birds. You don't know the birds in the Torah.
Water buffalo is also a beast of burden. It's also a domesticated animal.
But it's also wine.
Yeah,
and it's also maybe that's right. That could be. That it exists both in the wild and as a domesticated animal, and therefore perhaps that was one of, maybe there's a natural reason for that, or it's just the society and the way that it was dealt with. So the koi becomes a question mark here. In rabbinic law, the koi is dealt with, the koi has all of the chumras, all of the stringencies of both categories. That's the way you generally deal with these things. If you have two possibilities, and there are stringencies in both categories, so you give the koi all of the possibilities, all of the stringencies, in case he's the one or the case is the other. Okay, so that's how it's dealt with. Yes?
The wild animal, you have to kill with a weapon. The domestic animal, you don't, right?
No, most likely, yes. But yeah.
You can't catch it, but
no, we can't do that. And the kashrut of the animal, of course, would be violated by that because you have to.
But you could
capture the animal.
Yeah, I
can
capture
the animal. You fence it in. The Talmud has a lot of information. No. You have to fence the animal. You could do that. There are a variety of ways to trap the animal and then kill the animal in a proper slaughter, a proper method of slaughter. Okay, so I want to get a little bit further. Koi yesh bo derachim shaveh lechaya. There are ways that are like a chaya that pertain to a koi. Yesh bo derachim shel behema, and there are ways that are like a behema. Right. V'yesh bo derachim shaveh lechaya v'linahema. And there are things that are like both of them, as far as the law goes. V'yesh bo derachim she'eino shaveh lo lechaya v'lo lebehema. And it has its own peculiarities, which are neither like the behema nor the chaya. Okay? Now, so, the Gemara says, nitnei devarim. These are all abstract issues that we're dealing with the koi. Why doesn't it say divarim, things? Instead it says derachim, as if these are matters of nature. They can't be matters of nature here, because we're applying all kinds of unnatural categories to the koi, because we don't know what the nature of a koi is. Right? So it's another argument to say that derachim is really not the right word to use. If derachim only means what's natural, then it shouldn't have been used in this category. The two, and moreover, Maharaj thinks it's got something going now in its attack on the sole meaning of derech being nature. Says, moreover, there's another Mishnah. Zohachat min ha-devarim sheshavu gitei nashim l'shichur avadim. Sorry, I read that wrong. Right. This is one of the ways that the get of women is like the emancipation of slaves. Now, this is one of the laws of the emancipation of slaves involves the writing of a document, and the document has to be witnessed, and if the document has to be presented. And the agent, sometimes an agent can present the document, not the one who wrote the document. The agent presents the document. The agent is required to say, if asked, I was present at the signing of this document, and I know that these were the witnesses and that they're kosher witnesses. Okay? That is, in the law of the emancipation of slaves, that is one thing that pertains. Also true in the laws of Gittin. Okay? So that's one similarity between these two things. And there it says, Derachim. Well, that has nothing to do with nature at all. That has to deal with the laws of witnessing, laws of testimony. So here we're using Derech, obviously not to mean something which is pertains to nature. Elakolech of the Ikapalut, Nazak Mara says, you're right. And it leaves that whole line of argument, saying nature. And it has another approach to this question entirely. It says, Ella Koleth of the Ika Palupta, wherever there is a differentiation in the laws on a particular topic, Tani Derachim. The language of the Mishnah is Derachim. The Chol Ech of the Leka Palupta, and where there is no differentiation, no subcategories, no saying two and three, there's two ways to do it, there's three ways to do it. In that case, it uses Devarim. Okay? That's simply a stylistic fact in the creation of the law. Alright? Tani Devarim. Daikanami de Katani Sefer. And this is emphasized by the end of the Mishnah, which was about the Etrog. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Etrog shaveh le'ilan l'chol davar. An Etrog is like a tree in everything, according to Rabbi Eliezer. We read that the Etrog was like a tree in three things. According to Rabbi Eliezer, it's like a tree in four things, namely all the things. And what does he say? L'chol davar. Davar. Thing. So in other words, when it is a matter simply of one thing, they use davar. When it is a matter of a number of alternatives, they use derech. And now, according to the stylistic analysis of the Gemara, that's the reason why it says shalosh drachim. Because there were three different ways. If there were just one way, it would have used divarim, davar. Okay? So that's the meaning of the whole thing, okay? Maybe.
I find the point of the discussion very interesting because we are listening to Einstein's biography and the whole issue of light behaving as both a particle and as a wave, depending upon how you interrogate it. And having both properties, even though on their face they're mutually exclusive, but clearly the behavior is fits for both. And so I was fascinated with whether or not at any point in his early childhood before he had his own religious crisis, he had been introduced to the koi.
That's a fascinating question.
He wasn't koi.
The
he was the real
this subject actually there's another similar situation which I gave I'm just wondering any of you at the lecture that I gave a few years ago, this was at it wasn't called Limud, but it was at Temple, it was this annex to Temple Emmanuel, this big learning fest. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
I did it for, I think, 2 years. You were there.
Yeah.
Did you come to my lecture then?
I don't remember.
It's very memorable lecture. So I gave a lecture on another category, which is also like this, which is the case of a chamor, a donkey, which may not be a donkey. And it was maybe it's a donkey, maybe it's a not donkey. Because I was interested in the liminal cases, they call them. These are the cases where it's not this and it's not that, it could go this way, it could go that way, and how does the law deal with it when the law is not sure and there's no evidence? Or all the evidence you have, all the categories that you can apply, are not determinative. So there are really these two cases in Jewish law. One dealing with the donkey that has where you can't be sure about the donkey. And the other one is the koi. So it could have been Einstein had read about the donkey too. I don't know. I don't know which one. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Yeah. Let me just sum up here and conclude with this. Interestingly enough, the Gemara has come to a conclusion where it has rejected a line of argument that it was carrying on now for about a page. So you might say to yourself in reading this final conclusion, because it says Shmamina at the end of that, Shmamina means yes, that's right. In other words, it accepts that point of view. This is the last thing we read. It was Shmamina.
That's very comforting.
Whatever it was. So it says Shmamina. Does that mean that the previous discussion, what do we learn from the previous discussion as a result of the Shmamina? From my perspective, the Gemara exists not for its conclusions, but for what it takes to get to the conclusions. And what has happened is that, willy-nilly almost, but in order to explore the language of the Mishnah, we in fact have learned a number of things about marriage. In fact, we have emphasized the whole issue of nature and the naturalness of all of this, and that was an assumption of the text when it discussed it. Now, it finally turned out for stylistic reasons that the Gemara couldn't push that argument too far. And the Gemara will like to push an argument as far as it can, and when it can't do it, it stops. It has stopped.
It ran out of steam.
But that, in a way, just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, because it was where you've been till you get to that point that's what really counts. It's not the conclusion of the argument. Does it make any difference to you? I can tell you it makes no difference to me. The conclusion that they just drew. It's irrelevant. It's irrelevant to me. Whether two things are a derech and one thing is a davar, maybe. What is of interest to me was all the things that happened in the meantime. The fact that we brought up issues about marriage, which were part of getting somewhere, it was the elucidation of the general issue that's of interest to us. That really is what counts, as far as I'm concerned. Have I told you about the things you're buying now?
I'm just wondering whether somebody sat down and wanted to write this and put in everything that they could to answer this question, or whether they had a bunch of things that they wanted to write and then they decided to call it a decision.
I would say I have no idea how to answer that. But I would say you might want to ask that question of James Joyce also. You know, when you're dealing with a type of literature that isn't the simple exposition of an idea, but it, which just takes you into the psyche of someone or some phenomenon, I think that's a question that you're, in fact, you're left with, for which there is no adequate answer.
It's a stream of consciousness.
Yeah, something, some of this is stream of consciousness, and therefore, in a way, you don't know what's in fact motivating it. All you are exposed to is this stream of consciousness, and in fact, you could argue both sides of that question, I think.
That's like the question.
Exactly. We're back to arguing two sides.
Thank you. Thank you.